And joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon, I'm really excited to say, is Elizabeth Brooks. She is the Director of Planning and Design, of course, with the Lafayette Central Park, and here to talk to us about all kinds of things going on that wonderful green space, that 100 acres of green space that we have now. Before we talk about some of the details of the forums coming up that people get to participate in, Elizabeth, I would like to go back a little bit to the beginning because, you know, we sometimes assume that people remember everything and the process and how we got to where we were. But sometimes our memories are short or we just weren't present at that time and we don't really know, even though it is very recent history. So let's just kind of go back a little bit because you were very instrumental in why we have this space now, this Lafayette Central Park space. So if you just remind people what you did and who all was helping you at that time.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Judith. This is a really exciting opportunity. Yes, back in 2005, the university owned the land. They bought it from the Scheffler family in 1920. And it's a beautiful 100 acres right in the middle of Lafayette. But at the time, it was outside of town, pretty far outside of town. I mean, Johnson Street was a dirt road. Judison was probably came about 30 years later. So they bought it for $11,800, if you can imagine
that. In the 20s. Oh, my.
In 1920. Mm-hmm. And so they operated it as a dairy farm for many, many years. Several university presidents and university officials lived on the farm property. There were two houses, one in the front and one on the back. They moved the cattle in the 1980s off the property to a farm that we have now in Cade, and they brought horses on. And so that's kind of where it earned its nickname, the horse farm. And they had equestrian kind of riding and veterinary science kind of classes out there. And I went out there for several of my renewable resources classes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was just a really sacred space. It was beautiful, and it had a big red barn. And so in 2005, they had moved the horses off again with the cows in Cade. But in 2005, the newspaper broke a story that they were going to be doing a land swap and they were going to develop this piece of property. So immediately, me and my best friend Danica Adams, who actually was the last person to live on the horse farm in that little white house on the front of the property,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a dorm for free for an exchange for like 10 hours of work a week at the Horticultural Center, if you can believe that. 100-acre backyard, free dorm, in exchange for like a little bit of work,
and so
watering
she was,
plants.
She was very aware of how beautiful the space was because it was her backyard for a while.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so immediately she, you know, we ran out of class. She was crying and we just made a pact right there on the steps of Hamilton Hall to do our best to not let anything happen to this property. And so immediately we launched a website. It was SaveTheHorseFarm.com, and we bought a bunch of yard signs that led people to the website and started, you know, MySpace and Facebook pages and an online petition, and just did everything that we could to first stop the rezoning of the property because that was kind of the most immediate threat. And then to really just kind of move forward with what are the alternatives that could make it a win-win for the university, but also a win-win for the community so that we could preserve this green space into perpetuity for generations to come.
You know, I know we've all had those conversations, and those of us who are from here or have lived here for any length of time, where we say, oh, do you remember that? You know, when I was living here back in 1975, that was a farm. That was beautiful property. I often have conversations with people like that, and it's just gone. Those spaces are gone. Those beautiful trees are gone. And we all have memories of Lafayette at a different time when there were more green spaces and the beauty of the landscape was much more evident. But it's harder and harder to find that. And you really touched that feeling in a lot of people because for so many of us, well, what were we to do? It was obviously belonged to somebody else. You have no influence, but you made it very much a part of all of our emotional memories and desires to retain that beauty of Lafayette Parish as we remembered it.
Well, and it is such a beautiful piece of property that really tugs on the agrarian heartstrings of our past.
Mm-hmm.
It has rolling hills. It has the Coulee Mean that runs through it. Huge, beautiful, 100-year plus oaks. There's a beautiful wooded ravine that runs back through the about halfway through the property. And if you actually look from Johnson Street, it's a very narrow piece of property, actually. It's about 6 acres wide, and it goes over 20 acres deep almost. So about 7/10 of a mile deep, if you can believe that. So the portion that you can see from Johnson Street is really just the halfway point. The tree line in the very back of that view is the very beginning of the second half of the farm. So, you know, the fact that we've got 100 acres that really kind of represents this kind of agrarian pastoral landscape that Lafayette used to have a lot more of,
right,
is really great. And I really think that we have a lot of opportunities coming up to really mm-hmm. kind of enhance that and kind of remind children of future generations what Lafayette used to be like. But, you know, to be really honest, Lafayette is really underserved by park space acreage. We are way below the national average. We're actually pretty far below the state average. And so I think I heard somewhere that adding this 100 acres actually increased our park space acreage per capita by 10%. So it's a pretty significant addition to our kind of park system. So we're really excited about it, and I think that it's got a lot of potential.
Yes. So once you had secured this and made everyone very conscious of this space and the beauty of this space, you were quite successful, and it did work out. What has been the process since then? I think not everyone quite knows what has happened between that point and the Lafayette Central Park. There were a lot of people very instrumental in getting you all to that point.
There really were. And the first and foremost, I would like to thank City Parish President Joey Durrell. He has been very instrumental in making sure that the right people came to the table to make this deal happen. And so he really made sure that the council kind of, you know, passed things along the way, a resolution to support it. And then eventually in 2012, July 2012, the City Parish Council voted to purchase the property with city tax dollars. So, and additionally, there was a small land swap to give the university Youth Guidry Park, which is kind of basically the only open space contiguous to the university outside of Girard Park that they could expand upon. So it was kind of a win-win, again, that we were kind of looking for. And so the city council, the mayor, and the CFA, the Community Foundation of Acadiana, has also been very instrumental. They got in those discussions very early on to try to figure out how to make it financially sustainable and make sure that the transfer between the city and the university worked out in all favor or in favor of all parties. And so we, after the property was transferred in July of 2012, the Community Foundation of Acadiana kind of formed a committee to kind of think through a new nonprofit that would oversee the design, development, construction, and long-term operation and maintenance of this park. So that is where Lafayette Central Park was born, and that nonprofit was founded in January this year. And then in late April, early May, they hired their first two staff people. I'm the director of planning and design, and David Calhoun is the executive director. And we have just been working. I mean, we hit the ground sprinting and immediately pulled in the Urban Land Institute, which is a very well-renowned planning and real estate nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. So they came down and they sent a team in June that just really did an amazing job trying to help us develop a roadmap of how we could get from where we were, which was, you know, a blank slate, beautiful piece of property, this great story, to how we could get all of the community's input to make sure that this really represented a community vision-driven park. Mm. So after Urban Land Institute laid out that roadmap, we hired a master planning firm. We put out an RFP, and got 16 submissions from national landscape architecture firms, I mean, and many of them with international accord. And they, I mean, if you thought of any of the parks that you really love across the country and sometimes across the globe, I almost guarantee you that one of the firms that kind of put in to do the horse farm literally was one of those firms. I mean, it was an amazing list, and it was a very difficult decision-making process that we had to use to select the final one. We had six come in for interviews, took a full day. And we're just really just astonished by how much interest there was across the country in this 100 acres right in the middle of Lafayette. I mean, it was really, really impressive.
Across the country, that still has to be unusual in the middle of a city, a well-developed city, to suddenly be given that kind of acreage of
absolutely.
Green space.
I mean,
they must have been thrilled to apply.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. It's a very rare occasion. And mm-hmm. so I think it was kind of every landscape architect's dream, you know, because it is surrounded on all sides by pretty well-established neighborhoods and retailers. And it really does have the potential to be a central park, you know. And so we ended up hiring Design Workshop. Or I guess I should say a team led by Design Workshop. And they're a fantastic firm out of Austin, Texas. And they also have several other satellite locations like in Aspen, Colorado and elsewhere. But, you know, over 60% of their team was either born or educated here in Louisiana. So they had a lot of local ties. Several of their members actually live in Lafayette or in Baton Rouge. So they have several subcontractors. One of them is Mater Engineering, who has actually already worked on the Cooley Mean. So, you know, kind of that institutional knowledge is already there. And then they also hired Bill Fontenot, who is the nature dude. I'm sure mm-hmm. some people listening mm-hmm. know that guy. So he's their kind of on-hand ecologist. They also hired Dr. Ray Brasseur, who is a professor here at the university, as kind of their cultural, historic kind of expert. And then they hired ETM and Associates. And this was really key because ETM Associates is probably one of the foremost firms that kind of does consulting in park sustainability, like financial sustainability, because you certainly don't want to build something that looks flashy when you cut the ribbon and allow people to go in. And then 7 years later, you actually haven't thought through how you're actually going to operate and maintain that. So part of that was really important because you really just want to circle back at almost every single decision you make and not only talk about the capital costs of constructing it, but how much it actually costs to run it into perpetuity so that you kind of never get ahead of yourself in that. So, and then the final subcontractor on that team was Perry Franklin and Associates, and they are out of Baton Rouge, and they're kind of the engagement strategists, and they've done work all over the country, and they're just really great at making sure that the community is heard, that those statements and that kind of vision that comes out of the community transforms into the design.
Well, you know, I'm just going to ask you something personal as well, because people are listening to you going, wasn't she just a student on the steps, like high-fiving her friend, saying, we're going to save this land? Something happened after that. You did go on to school and continue in public policy. Tell us just a bit about that degree, because you've matured as a public person in these years convening since then.
Well, thank you. I always kind of joke with people that I tried to create this job. I was like, man, I know exactly what I need to do. Mm-hmm. So I graduated from UL with degrees in environmental and sustainable resources and Spanish. And then I was supposed to go to the Peace Corps, but I kept, you know, putting it off. And they were like, lady, you can't put this off anymore. So, but I decided that I really needed to stay in Lafayette and save the horse farm and help my own community before I went gallivanting off across the mm-hmm. globe and helped mm-hmm. some other community. So I stayed in town for several years and just, you know, had weekly meetings about the horse farm and did what I could. And then in 2008, things seemed like it was pretty well on the path of being saved. It was probably just a lot more legwork on the city side and the university working out the negotiations. So I went off to Houston and I was a City Hall Fellow, and I worked underneath Mayor Bill White, and I worked on green purchasing initiatives and recycling and a Hurricane Ike hit. So I worked on a lot of debris management. And then I went to grad school at UT Austin and studied urban planning and urban design, and worked at the Center for Sustainable Development while I was there, and then was recruited back to Houston to go work for a former city council member, Peter Brown, and his new nonprofit, Better Houston. And I was a project manager that worked on a lot of livable center studies there and complete streets. They actually just passed a complete streets policy a few days ago. And then was whisked back here to become the director of planning and design for Lafayette Central Park, which is my dream job.
What an amazing path. What a great way to prepare yourself for coming back to this community, having had that wonderful vision earlier, but to really have matured professionally and publicly as well. So in your work, in your dealings with other cities, you have obviously seen cities that value parks and seen different kinds of parks. What does that do to a community? I mean, I think that still is a question in a lot of people's minds. You know, well, we've done fine for so long with Girard Park, and if you don't have something, it may be something you don't think about that much. What does it do for a community to have a really well-established, large central park?
Absolutely. And I think you're right. It is kind of one of those situations where if it's not in your community already, it's hard to understand the benefits of what you may not see that you're missing. You know, I think there's so many facets to why parks are so important. I think that not only do they kind of provide outdoor recreation spaces that have ties to public health, to environmental education, to alternative transportation. You know, I mean, honestly, if you can't bike somewhere, if you don't have places to bike, then you certainly won't do it. And the other thing is that it's an amazing economic development tool. I mean, now it seems as though, you know, there's all of these kind of creative class and these knowledge-based workers that communities are really trying to attract if they don't already exist, which, you know, we do obviously have a really good base here, but we're obviously always trying to attract new jobs, new businesses, new headquarters even. And businesses that can move anywhere, they look at the quality of life of the places that they're looking at. You know, they look at their options, and park spaces are obviously a huge part of that. And so, you know, trying to think through how we can create a much larger network, even beyond the horse farm, actually, to really kind of increase that aspect of quality of life, I think is one of the key things that we're hoping will come out of this, that the horse farm will not only create this central park for Lafayette, but it that will also catalyze a lot of new thinkings and a lot of kind of new relationships will be formed that can shape a future kind of green space network and alternative transportation network in town.
Well, yes, to kind of transform our understanding of what that means, because when I mentioned Girard Park, I'm thinking, well, there's a lot of other parks, but they tend to be baseball fields, soccer fields, they're athletic spaces and not necessarily what we're talking about
right here
or the vision that's involved here.
Well, and that's one of the things that we kind of fought for all along. We have a lot of sports fields in Lafayette. I mean, even though we're still underserved by park space acreage, if you take out the sports fields and the golf courses, we're really, really underserved.
So even with those, we're underserved.
Even with those, mm-hmm. we are underserved. But when you take those out, it's really bad. Mm-hmm. You basically have like Acadiana Park on the north side and then Girard Park, you know. And they're both great parks. They're absolutely influential and instrumental in kind of our network. But so one of the few things that is in the restricted covenant that came with the transfer from the university to the city is that there won't be any organized sports and that there won't be any golf. And so we're kind of free and clear of those two things that really would take up a big chunk of the acreage and also would really change the feel of it. And I think that's that pastoral nature of the horse farm that we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. I think that's really going to be preserved and enhanced. And it's so amazing. If you haven't been out there, we encourage you to please go during the Saturday farmers markets, because you can go about halfway down the property and look back and you can see all these cars driving by on Johnson Street, but all you can hear is birds and wind in the trees. And it's really amazing because it is such a little respite of nature mm-hmm. right in the middle of Lafayette.
And we all in this culture like to talk about our connection to the past. We like to talk about our connection to ancestors, cultural ways, folk ways, food ways. But there's so little left. We're such a heavily populated rural area. Everyone stays, of course, because they love it. But there is so little understanding of what that actually was like, those spaces that our ancestors must have encountered. So you're really offering us that opportunity.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and then, you know, there is – so Coulee Mean actually goes down all the way to the Vermilion River, right by Rotary Point, actually, on West Bay Parkway. And so the potential to kind of maybe tie into Rotary Point and then tie into the river and tie into all of the parks that touch the river, mm-hmm. you know. And actually, I'm not sure if you've been to Boston, but there's this emerald necklace of parks that are connected by all of these different linear greenways. Well, how can we maybe have a string of pearls or something similar where
with
we can
waterways.
Actually
–
yeah, these mm-hmm. use the river mm-hmm. as kind of a connection of all of these different things, since it's been such an instrumental part of our community so
right.
far.
Well, I want to tell people who may be tuning in, my guest is Elizabeth Brooks. She is the Director of Planning and Design for the Lafayette Central Park Incorporated, here talking a bit about the history of how it came to be that we have this space, this 100 acres. And what you're starting to talk about here is the planning part. So right now, you're hoping to encourage people to become involved in this planning process. All of the parts are in place, finally. You have this nonprofit organization. You've hired the design firm who are very connected locally. What is this next step that you're hoping people would become involved in? You have a number of public forums that have been scheduled. What is the the place of the public in this?
So we've tried to set a series of public workshops all over the city at all of these different times so that we can capture as many ideas as we can. And we're really committed to having a blank slate. I mean, we really don't have any plans whatsoever. And so the point now is really to get the community to come out and tell us what they think Lafayette Central Park or the horse farm should be and what they think is missing from other parks in Lafayette. And then part of the design firm's job is to kind of inspire them. Well, if it's outside of your paradigm, you know, it's hard, like we were saying earlier, it's kind of hard to think about it if you haven't seen it before. And so part of the presentation will be kind of inspirational images from around the world of other parks and what they've done. So there'll be 2-hour workshops, and we ask that people try to come for the full 2 hours. It's not really an open house. We'll obviously be able to kind of accommodate you if you do come in, but it will be staged where they'll have like a presentation. They'll have these inspirational images, some breakout sessions where we'll do brainstorming and capture all of these different ideas that people put out there. And then come back together, and we're going to do some really cool keypad voting where, you know, it's kind of real time where you're given this little keypad and essentially they ask you a question, everybody votes, and then when the vote's over, they show the results right there on the screen, which is a really amazing way to engage people because it starts the conversation right then. You don't have to take the results and a month later talk about how you tabulated it and, you know, Lafayette seems to want this. It's like right there in the middle of the studio, you're having that conversation.
Right. And what a great thing to, I guess, jumpstart people's ideas about parks because we have so little example here in our community. And that helps because that sparks other ideas as well, trying to fit that with what we already have here. So when is the first forum?
The first forum is next Wednesday, and it will be from 11 to 1. And that's going to be at the Rosa Parks Transportation Center, which is at 101 Jefferson Street, down by the post office. And it'll be in their community room on that first floor. And then later on that evening, there will be another one from 6 to 8 p.m., and that's going to be at the South Regional Library at 6101 Johnson Street. And if you haven't been to that library, you should absolutely go. It's a beautiful space. And then on Thursday, another set of two from 11 to 1 will be at the Hyman Center Ballroom, which is 1373 South College, but I'm sure most people know where the Hyman Center is. And then from 6 to 8 p.m., it'll be at the Martin Luther King Center, which is at 309 Cora. On Friday, we'll actually be here at UL. So we'll be in Fletcher Hall in the auditorium. And for those of you who don't know, Fletcher Hall is the white building on the corner of Lewis and Girard Park Drive. And that auditorium is room 134. And we'll be there actually from 12:30 to 2:30 because the university kind of ends their day at 12:30. So it'll really hopefully capture a large, you know, portion of this community here, of this faculty and staff and students. And then on Saturday, our final set of this workshop will be at the farmer's market at the horse farm. So 2913 Johnson Street, in case you don't know where the horse farm is. And we'll be there. And of course, because of the nature of the farmer's market, it'll be a little bit more informal where it'll be paper ballots instead of kind of the keypad voting. But we'll still be able to capture all of these ideas. And it's really important that the community try to make one of these ideas because we really want to hear from you. And we really also want to hear the choruses. I mean, I'm sure that some people are going to say, oh, I don't need to go because Betsy Sue is going to go and say that she wants them to save the trees. Well, we want to hear that thousands of people want them to save the trees, you know, and I don't think the trees are really in danger, but, you know, that kind of thing. I think we really want to hear the choruses come out and say what's important to them. So we hope that everybody will be able to make at least one of these.
So the horse farm, the one that's at the horse farm on Saturday, the 26th, you're essentially going through the same process with showing the examples and having people put their vote in as well.
Absolutely. I think the format will be a little more informal. Mm-hmm. The pictures will probably be printed instead of on the screen. But yeah, we're going to have the same kind of thing.
All right. And I know that you've been passing out these great fans all over the place. People have them. And I'm sure on your website or Facebook page, you have this complete schedule if people weren't jotting it down.
Absolutely.
But it does start next week, and there will be 4 days with like 2 sessions each day. So we have a lot of opportunities to get involved.
Absolutely.
Now, there's going to be a quick turnaround at these sessions, but then on in November, towards the end of November, you're having people come back. You want them to come back. And is there going to be some kind of plan, a sketch of a plan at that point?
Well, that's actually going to come in December. So these are kind of month-long you know, kind of very concise efforts. So the first one is the brainstorming. Give us all of the ideas. And then in November, from the 19th through the 21st, we're going to have two a day on each of those days. And that's all on the website as well. And that's going to be a little bit more about scale. So it'll be first a test to make sure that we heard Lafayette correctly. So we're going to come back and say, okay, we heard you, that you want this, you want that, you don't want this, and you think this is really important. And once that happens, and once we kind of validate those, you know, those kinds of wishes, then we're going to start talking about the size. Okay, well, so you said that you wanted a flower garden. Well, is it, you know, is it just a small little plot of flowers, or is it a full acre flower garden? You know, and so those kinds of things. And again, we have no plans, so I can't really throw anything out here. But but yeah, so essentially this next set is going to be really important to try to evaluate, like, how big and how many people does this element accommodate, and what was the feeling? Because there's obviously a big difference between a 10-acre flower garden and a, you know, a small half-acre flower garden. So yeah, and then in December, on December the 3rd, that is when we'll come back. We'll boil all these ideas that have to do with size and scale, boil those down even further to a couple of conceptual plans. I mean, they're going to be – it's not going to be construction documents and designed, but it will be kind of a bubble diagram talking about the importance of adjacencies. I mean, you wouldn't want to put like a meditation garden next to a dog park, you know, because obviously there's just a couple of conflicts of sound and things that, you know, would disturb some people. So so then that phase will really be about – the buffers, the adjacencies, kind of like which plan do you like better, and do we pick a hybrid of these two or three? And so that's really kind of where we can kind of pick the final. That's my favorite. That's my favorite part.
Well, it's interesting to hear you even throw out those few ideas you just did. Zen garden, meditation garden, dog park, at flower garden. I mean, those are things that have not been sustained in our notion of what a park is ever in Lafayette.
Right.
But around the country, as you mentioned, those can be quite common in
Absolutely.
Some people's parks.
Absolutely.
So in their presentation, they will be throwing out more ideas like that that we might not have ever encountered.
Absolutely. Here. And that's what we really look forward to, is hearing these wild ideas that no one's ever thought of before. And I think that's the exciting part. You know, we really have such an opportunity to leave a legacy for Lafayette. And I just think this is a really fantastic way to do it. Just get all the ideas and then boil them down piece by piece until we kind of come up with something that everybody is really proud of.
And again, if you are tuning in, Elizabeth Brooks is with me here in the studio, the KRVS Studios. She is the Director of Planning and Design for Lafayette Central Park Incorporated, here talking about the history of the horse farm and now Lafayette Central Park, and also the public forums that are coming up starting next week. You can like their Facebook page and be kept up with all of the events that are happening and what's going on with the plan. You probably have a more static website as well that people can stop by, and just lots of ways to get information these days. So what is the process after that? I know there's a lot of, you know, this is a fabulous exercise that people are going through, but I think people are kind of wondering, well, when can we go to the park? what kind of time frame are you thinking about?
Well, so I think that we're going to once we kind of have this program, the park program of what goes in the park, not where it goes necessarily, what it looks like, but where it goes, we'll have that by December. And then we're going to take that to the city council on December 17th, 5:30, Tuesday, December 17th. We encourage everyone to go. And if that's passed, we'll go ahead and start working on the design. And really, that's where – you know, how does this curb interact with the grass? That kind of all those construction documents will really kind of take place. And we're hoping that that can all be done within about 6 months. And then we're hoping to break ground next summer. So we have a very aggressive timeline. So hopefully we're going to break ground next summer. And then hopefully, if everything goes as planned. But again, it's hard to say these things because we don't know what we're building. I mean, we don't have any plans, so it's kind of like, well, is it going to take 14 months, or is it going to take 12 or 16? So we're aiming for 14 months of construction, and we're really hoping that, of course, it depends on what we build and where things go and what Lafayette wants, but we're hoping that we'll be able to do it in phases so that only this portion that we're building at this time is going to be blocked off, and only this portion that we're building is going to be blocked off the month after that, so that the rest of the park can really be open and enjoyed during the construction process. We'll just have to see how that goes because, again, we don't have any plans, so it's hard to make those calls, but we are hoping that there will at least be some phasing, so it's not all just, you know, blocked off for 14 months and then, you know, have a grand opening. So,
right. And so until that point, though, will you continue to have the weekly artisans market and farmers market? And how long will that continue? Or will there be a period where that stops?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that all of the events that are happening right now are absolutely guaranteed until April 30th, and that was kind of the mayor's cutoff date because currently the mayor and his office run the park, and we won't really take control of it until we break ground. So I'm hoping that it will be able to find a spot, you know, so that we don't have to, like, relocate it to a parking lot or something. But I think there's a good chance that we'll be able to accommodate it and it won't have to shut down completely or anything. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wouldn't shut down completely. It would probably just relocate maybe to the parking lot next door or something like that. I'm not sure.
Not far away.
Not far away, hopefully. Yeah. But those are all kind of things that we need to – the TBD, to be determined.
Absolutely.
So – but those are definitely things that people can say at these forums.
All right. So that starts next week on October 23rd. Check out their Facebook page for a complete listing or go to their website. That's LafayetteCentralPark.org. And you can search for that on Facebook as well. And we hope to have you back once the plan is revealed and you can let us know more about it. Again, my guest Elizabeth Brooks is Director of Planning and Design for the Lafayette Central Park Incorporated. And that was the horse farm, which started with two friends on some steps here at UL Lafayette.
That's true. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you. It is Thursday afternoon when KRVS presents From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bork, reading works by writers from or inspired by Louisiana.
The first poem, Jean Lafitte at Bath, by Jack B. Bedell, from Bone Hollow True, New and Selected Poems. Jean Lafitte at Bath. I put my son to bath the other night and set about shaving for my next day's work. His load of toys seemed random at first glance. A few ships with crew, rubber alligators, a treasure chest of Mardi Gras doubloons. Nothing worth breaking the comfort of lather and blade until I heard my mother in his voice. He told himself the story of Jean Lafitte in the same words my mother had used for me. How the pirate sailed up Bayou Lafourche to hide his treasure from the English Navy, resting only on moonlit nights, tying his ship to the banks, his men pitching chicken parts in all directions to draw the alligators so no one could swim up on them as they slept. He poured these words without taking a breath, like the Frenchman's freedom meant something to us all, like the victory of watching the English sails wander aimlessly around Grand Isle was our own treasure to share coin by coin. He ordered his men to leave food and clothes at every dock just to make it so. I didn't even have to turn around to feel the pirate's sunrise on my neck, to see my son's blue eyes glimmer at the shore, as the trapper's daughters stepped toward him, giggling, his ship making its way to open waters, that Frenchman's treasure safe and glistening as it fell straight from my mother's hands to his. And the second poem by Jack B. Bedell from Bone Hollow True, New and Selected Poems, published by Texas Review Press, One Morning Over Dove. My wife is not afraid of blood or knives. She spent all morning cleaning the doves brother and I swept from the soybean fields beside our land. She scrapes the hearts and livers out with her fingers into a bowl and piles the rest of the birds onto the table. By the time I step out back to stow the shotguns, she's already filled a pail with meat for the week's stew and wants to talk of love and children and time. The whole while she builds a stain on her forehead, brushing away a hair that interrupts important points of room temperatures and ovulations. I wipe down my 20-gauge and wonder at the tenderness she holds in her voice while elbow-deep in gore. The space between her words and mine is enough to register desire, and more than enough for her to clean two doves, reaching her fingers into their chests, popping the meat out with a subtle snap. Thank you.
Join KRVS each Thursday afternoon for From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque. And with me in the KRVS studios now are Mariusz Smolik, conductor of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra, and composer Glenn McClure, who is here because a symphony commissioned a wonderful piece called The Legacy of the Atchafalaya, an environmental oratorio. And, you know, I was just thinking as Michael Duse was wailing away on that fiddle, That was actually a perfect introduction to the symphony this time. Oftentimes it's not quite so connected, But with this wonderful piece that Glenn has composed for the concert on Saturday. That's kind of a nice lead-in. So give us a brief history. I know that at the beginning of the season you spoke about the commissioned work and a little bit about how it came about. But tell us why you commissioned the piece and how it interfaces with the symphony season.
Thank you very much for having us giving us opportunity to talk about what the ASO is doing this weekend. The overall theme for our season is water, which is first in the series of different elements that we're going to study through the eyes of music. And when you think about water in Louisiana and living in Lafayette, you can't escape the presence and the importance of the local bayous and the rivers and, of course, the Atchafalaya. So for me, it was a very logical direction to turn to. But how to make it a valid symphonic presentation was another step. And what really helped me finalize my plan how to incorporate the local water with what we are doing was the initiative of the local Boy Scouts who were celebrating a few years ago the 100th anniversary of establishing the local scouting organization. They made a pledge to the Atchafalaya Basin that they will take care of that beautiful place of nature for the next 100 years. And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to marry their initiative, our interest in water. And I think we often see different sort of media and arts as the way to comment on the present activities and present life. But I think historically, many of the important historical pieces, operas, symphonies in a way, other performing arts creations, were also commenting on what was happening in the history of a given place. So I think a musical commentary on our interest in water, the scouts' interest in Atchafalaya, that can be commented through a new piece. So I found Glenn through some research, and I found that he actually did something similar in the past when he was writing a musical commentary on the project in Connecticut, also that had some environmental implications. So we started talking, and you mentioned Mike Duse playing violin and introducing this segment of the program. And when I think about the local water, local nature, you can't escape the local musical traditions. So as the concept of the piece started to evolve, I immediately turned Glenn's attention to the world of local folk music. And I told him, you really should look at that as an important component of making this commentary and writing that piece. So very quickly, those different blocks came together. Glenn, who is from upstate New York, came here to visit our place, get a sense of the local culture. We went to a Balfour's Cajun music camp. He went down in the swamp and paddled in the kayak, and we went to Festival International. So I think after that, he got the badge of a qualified composer to write a piece about
what. Boy Scout badge, too.
Boy Scout badge to be a qualified composer for that project. And he'd been working on it for several months, and we'll see the fruits of our labor in about 48 hours.
This at the Hyman Performing Arts Center on Saturday. Well, Glenn, welcome back to our community.
Thank you so much.
So you had a full experience back in April. What were your first thoughts when Mariusz contacted you? I mean, as he mentioned, this wasn't the first time that you've done this kind of environmental composition or worked with ethnic groups. But what did you think of when he explained what he was interested in?
Well, first of all, it was so gratifying to get a call from a symphony conductor that asks this question. Asks a question of partnership, right. Asks a question mm-hmm. of how can we put these different parts of our community together in a singular expression of some mm-hmm. kind. Mm-hmm. That's not the kind of questions of most conductors ask. Okay, and so that's to Mariusz's credit to be looking at the ASO as a an expression of the larger community, not just simply as an organization that carries on classical music,
imposes a certain idea of music on the community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that I was very excited about it because the chance to work with Christine Balfa, who is famous in so many ways, even way up in the Northeast, that was a wonderful treat, and also to explore this other dance music tradition. Up in my area, I grew up in the midst of a bunch of old-time ethnic music players, none of them Cajun, okay, but Scotch-Irish players, old-time Italian players. And so I felt very much at home when we were out with Christine at the Cajun music camp mm-hmm. that day.
I guess one of the different things here is the number of young people who play. It's not just the older ethnic musicians. It's very vibrant here. It's very much alive. It's not just strains from a distant past that we're performing here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that adds another element to it as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, for me, though, those traditions back home are continue to bubble along. They don't have the kind of public recognition mm-hmm. and just sheer cultural power and force that Cajun music does.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure people are very curious how you go about creating something from these different elements. You were obviously very pleased that Mariusz was so sensitive to the culture and this partnership was very important to him. But how do you go about doing that musically? And to you, that may be something very natural, but for us to think, okay, he's given Cajun and Creole music. He's been taken on a swamp tour and told how committed the Boy Scouts are. How do you start musically creating something that reflects all of that, especially the environmental part?
Okay. Well, let's start with the environmental part. The form of the tone poem, okay, the musical picture, okay, that is something any classical music fan is aware of. Anyone who watches movies and listen to the soundtrack, okay, those film composers are doing very much the same thing, mm-hmm. There's that opening sense of geez, how do we take sound and mimic. Okay, this experience of the swamp. When I went out on the bayou and we were going along at a pretty good clip and it was looking like the bayou was going to end, but it was really this place where the Boy Scout leaders called the wall. Okay, in which the open bayou just shuts down into this dark, deep, rich swamp that in the first movement of the piece we have that motion at the beginning of
continuing
gathering.
On into the darkness and the thickness of the
mm-hmm. right yeah but to go deeper than that okay since the Boy Scouts are studying the swamp okay and there's increased interest in scientific research of the swamp. What I did was to ask for scientific data, okay, from various parts of the swamp, and the Boy Scouts generated some water level data for me, and I took that data and ran it through a couple of different equations, okay, where I could take those numbers and turn them into pitches. Okay, so the a large part of the first movement, the sort of tone poem section, is based upon a chord progression that is generated by two individual lines that are lifted right out of the data.
So they're related to those water levels.
Yeah, in a very mathematical kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, the sound not only embeds a sort of emotional experience, but it also embeds the scientific research that's going into it as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How fascinating. I mean, you often hear that between music and math, there is a correlation, you know, but you're actually physically incorporating that into the sound of your piece. Yeah. I want to tell people who may just be tuning in at this moment, my guests are Mariusz Smoly, conductor of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra, and Glenn McClure. He's a composer who was commissioned by the symphony to produce a piece called The Legacy of the Atchafalaya, which goes very nicely with their theme of water throughout the year and working with the Boy Scouts and honoring their commitment to the Atchafalaya and the water of this area. So you have all these elements, and in addition to that, the Boy Scouts, or at least one of the Boy Scouts, wrote a poem. And so you have language incorporated in with your piece as well.
Right. Yeah. I think that you know, the presence of the Atchafalaya Basin here, okay, it is one central part of the community, but it's seen by different constituencies in so many different ways. Okay. And some as a livelihood, some as a place that reminds them of their tradition. Okay, tourists coming in, enjoying the beauty, scientists, and so we also really wanted to have the Boy Scouts' view of this place, which the two poems that we got, the two writing samples were wonderful mixes of an emotional response to this beautiful place, a hope for preserving it in the future, and also a real desire to explain the role of the Atchafalaya here in ways that maybe folks that are just driving across the bridge wouldn't think, you know, to go more deeply into their relationship with the Swamp Basin. Mm-hmm.
So how is that incorporated, the words? Do you have music behind them and they will be reciting it live? They'll be there.
Yes, we'll have two Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. The authors of the poem actually were not available. One of them is now in college. He wrote it as a senior in Lafayette High School. Mm-hmm. Now he is in college. But I really like the poem. It's really, really well written. His name is Derek Brew. So his poem will be recited by two younger colleagues. And also the other poem is the basis of a song, mm-hmm. right, that Christine and Children Choir will be singing.
Oh, okay.
We have many different parts into this presentation. We have orchestra, of course. We have a children choir. We have Christine Balfa singing. We have children choir singing. And also we're going to show on the big screen above the orchestra some of the very most astounding, beautiful photographs that the scouts made last summer, showing the beauty, the visual component of telling the story of
really
the Atchafalaya.
Really complimenting this tone poem,
right.
This tone oratorio. Yeah. Well, did you write the music that Christine Balfa will be playing, or is this more traditional music? How is that incorporated?
I did write the music, mm-hmm. but wrote it with a strong reference toward this beautiful beautiful musical tradition that mm-hmm. that Christine is such an important a representative of here. So it pulls elements mm-hmm. of the style into that.
Is it giving too much away to say which songs, which melodies perhaps you pulled from? Or were there any particular melodies that you were struck by and that aided you? And
No particular mm-hmm. ones. I just listened to stacks and stacks and stacks of it and walked away from that experience with a sense of what the musical language is mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. In this local tradition.
So how would you describe the feeling of that? I mean, I'm thinking of what Michael Doucet was just playing, that extremely mournful, and there are elements of that in Cajun music, although you don't get it in the dance halls quite as much. What elements, were emotional tones, were you looking for?
Yeah, the first movement definitely is is a movement that has a melancholy flavor mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. it. That Christine does some singing of one of these poems, and then we have the full poem that's mm-hmm. recited in the center of the piece. The second piece is just a joyful, fun one step.
A one step.
dance tune, very anthem like mm-hmm, in its quality here. We're hoping to get the audience to sing along a little bit here.
Dance in the aisles.
It won't be easy, but we'll see.
Well, I think people here, they're very proud of their traditions. They're very proud of their music, proud of everything here. And it's all, they're fascinated by how people interpret it mm-hmm. and what they pick out of it, what they see. And they're very watchful about it, but most appreciative generally that someone has been interested and incorporated it and create something even bigger and higher out of our own background.
Yeah. Well, it's a real privilege to get to know people here and to have this piece of music played by the mm-hmm. the ASO and of course to have Christine singing along.
Absolutely. So. Again, my guest composer Glenn McClure has composed a piece for the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra. It's called The Legacy of the Atchafalaya. It will be performed this Saturday with the symphony. And so, of course, you know, you've come to Louisiana in two of the most beautiful months of the year. You've come in April and October. Mm-hmm. They didn't make you come back in the middle of the summer in the Atchafalaya to experience?
Maybe next summer I'm going to have to go on one of those kayak trips.
That's right. You'll come back and do another work for some other element.
Right.
In addition to Legacy of the Atchafalaya, which that's the title of the entire concert, right. Really, but you'll be playing some other pieces as well.
We have two other major compositions on the program. We're going to start the concert with an interesting arrangement of music from West Side Story by Leonard Bernstein, which is based on his dance suite that Bernstein wrote himself for West Side Story, arrangement made especially for the Harlem String Quartet. And they will be playing the solo parts and visiting us in this unique arrangement of Bernstein's masterpiece. And we're going to end our concert with another important composer whose name starts with B. Then you need to change your last name. All the great composers start with B. I'm kidding.
I'll work on that. Yeah.
Right. Which is, in this case, Beethoven. And we're mm-hmm. going to perform his probably most famous symphony next to the Choral Symphony, which is Symphony Number 5, called the Fate Symphony.
It's one of the most famous introductory notes.
Everybody mm-hmm. knows that. Like everybody knows the smile of Mona Lisa from entire Da Vinci collection.
That's right. What an interesting piece to choose. I mean, that this idea that we're talking about the fate of the Atchafalaya and mm-hmm. how well are we going to maintain it and keep it mm-hmm. and nurture it as well. So there's a lot of, it is a very serious piece, but this is very serious talking about.
But you know, what's wonderful about the Fifth Symphony, it goes from the minor to the major. It's mm-hmm. from the darkness to light. Mm-hmm. And in a way, your composition also starts in the darker mood and ends with the lighter mood. And it's another little element that I think is important in the structure of the entire concert. It's another attempt on my part to show how different styles, very different styles of music can actually come together and how much you gain from listening to Bernstein in the light of Beethoven or listening to a new composition in the light of Bernstein. I think all those things feed off each other. It's as if you put on the wonderful plate many different fruits and suddenly the pineapple looks very different in the presence of few peaches and an apple rather than when you look at three peaches without anything around. And I think that's the power of music.
That we don't have to compartmentalize it, that if it's good, it's good. And they have connections. And you've been very good about doing that in our community with all of your mm-hmm. concerts and themes as well. We're just about out of time, but I want to let people know that the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra will perform this Saturday at the Hyman Performing Arts Center. It's a part of their season-long theme of water. And with them will be Glenn McClure, the composer of The Legacy of the Atchafalaya
Kephalaya, an environmental oratorio. Tickets are available through your website or at the Hyman Center?
Yes, through our website, through our, to the Hyman Center. And please remember, it's a 6 o'clock concert. We're trying the earlier times this time, first time this season. So if we are planning on joining us, please come at 6 o'clock because six about 7:30 will be done.
All right. 6 o'clock this Saturday at the Hyman Performing Arts Center. And, of course, your website is always available with more information.
Yes.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.